mentioning in the course of these lectures. Galileo, somebody who's, I don't think I need to name, Boltzmann, and then Emmy Noether. Now, Emmy Noether's face may not be as familiar to you as perhaps some of the others. Here are two more pictures of her. Of course, the reason that she comes up, of course, is because of her famous theorems, and in particular, the first theorem that relates symmetries and conservation principles in physics. Emmy Noether was celebrated in physics, of course, because of her 1918 paper that covered exactly these issues that I just mentioned. But she died at a relatively young age in 1935. She was teaching at Bryn Mawr University in the United States. And there was an international meeting that was held to commemorate her life and her achievements. And at this meeting, Hermann Weyl spoke and made the following description of her. She was not clay pressed by the artistic hands of God into harmonious form.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Of course.
There was a scheduling conflict that happened inadvertently. So there's a seminar going on that was scheduled now during the regular particle physics class, which is given by Stephen Johnston from Imperial College. On putting this particular one is on putting scalar field on the cause, et cetera, scalar particle, sort of an analog of this Feynman checkerboard, if people know about it. It's possible we could reschedule the seminar if enough people from this wanted to come to it, like it could be at 2 o'clock this afternoon. You would want to come? 1, 2, 3, 4. So there's roughly 4, 5, 6. Okay, on the order of 5 people. All right, so I'll go down with that information. It won't affect you now.
Thank you.
There might be another seminar through this afternoon.
Well, that's a relief. Thanks very much. Well, I was saying that Hermann Weyl made this remark about Noether, that she was not clay pressed by the artistic hands of God into a harmonious form, but rather a chunk of human primary rock into which he had blown his creative breath of life. Now, a few years ago, I gave a talk in the States on Emmy Noether's work, and Lee Smolin happened to be in the audience, and he told me that he'd read somewhere that Einstein had also attended this meeting, and Einstein stood up and said to Weyl, "You're not exactly a picture postcard yourself." Or words to that effect. Here are the topics I'm going to cover in these lectures. I'm going to start today with some distinctions and definitions just to fix ideas. And then I'm going to look at the Einstein relativity principle and its historical precedent. So today, the symmetry in question, the symmetry of interest, will be the relativity principle. And I'll end up with a discussion of the use of this principle by Albert Einstein in 1705. Albert Einstein in 1905, and Ignatovsky around 1910, to see how they used the principle of relativity in its phenomenological form. Now, since perimeter is a hotbed of quantum information and quantum foundations, one or two people expressed an interest in a paper I wrote recently with Christopher Tintz, where we argued that special relativity should not be used as a template for a fundamental reformulation of quantum mechanics. Now, a number of people have been expressing an interest in looking for some kind of analog of special relativity, in particular because of its economy of postulates, to see whether or not we could get some grip on the quantum mechanical nature of the world by seeing how to reconstruct quantum mechanics out of a small number of quasi-phenomenological, perhaps quantum information theoretic principles. And I thought it might be useful just to mention that Einstein himself, of course, had serious misgivings about his own 1905 formulation of special relativity. And I would give you a sense, a taste of what these misgivings were and why the so-called the thermodynamic template that he used in setting up special relativity is a double-edged sword. So I thought I'd give you a flavor of what it is, the price that you pay by introducing phenomenological principles as the basis of the theory in physics. Then the third topic will be Noether's first theorem. Now, Noether in 1918, Noether's paper has various parts. The most important part of the paper doesn't concern the theorem that makes the connection between conservation principles and symmetries. In fact, that connection was well known, certainly well known to Lagrange, Poincaré, and Jacobi, in the history of dynamics. That wasn't her target. Of course, she systematized the connection between symmetries and conservation principles in an unprecedented way. But her real interest had to do not with so-called global symmetries, the ones that are correlated with conservation principles, but with so-called local symmetries, and in particular the diffeomorphism invariants of the new theory of gravity due to Einstein, and something that had been of enormous interest to Hilbert. Hilbert came very, very close to beating Einstein to the field equations, general relativity. And Hilbert himself was very concerned, perhaps in a way that was even more important than to Einstein, what goes on with the conservation principles in general? Why is it you don't have a straightforward conservation principle in general relativity, despite the fact that you have this local symmetry, the diffeomorphism symmetry? And her second theorem concerns the implications of local symmetries in physical theories, the existence of local symmetries. And I'll come back to this shortly. But in relation to the first theorem, recently in the philosophical literature, there's been a certain amount of debate as to what explains what. Now, if you look at a typical textbook in physics, for example, if you look at Landau and Lifshitz on field theory or something like that, you'll find an expression to the effect that, well, we now understand conservation principles as being a result of, or engendered by, or somehow explained by the existence of certain kinds of symmetries in physics. Now, is the symmetry playing an explanatory role here? Or is it rather that what Noether established is a correlation between symmetries and conservation principles? So this is what I'll be looking at in the lecture in question, how to understand the first theorem. And also some recent applications in quantum mechanics and in electromagnetism. And the one in quantum mechanics might be of interest to people in quantum information theory. I'm hoping also there might be a small guest component to that lecture on recent applications of Noether's first theorem in doubly special relativity. Noether's second theorem, well, I've mentioned that this has to do with local symmetries. And it's interesting that in 1916, Einstein gave a Lagrangian formulation of general relativity, of his field equations in general relativity. And he essentially anticipated the special case of Noether's second theorem in general relativity. And I'll explain why this was so important to Einstein, and in particular in his rivalry with Hilbert, and what it was that Einstein saw in the application of Noether's second theorem that was so important in distinguishing his approach to gravity from Hilbert's, David Hilbert's. And then the next topic is Galilean covariance in quantum mechanics. Well, in textbooks on quantum mechanics, you generally see claims to the effect that the Schrodinger equation is Galilean covariant, and almost invariably, it'll be either the free Schrodinger equation or the Schrodinger equation with a scalar potential. And the question arises, what happens when you have a vector potential that represents a velocity-dependent force like magnetism, electromagnetism? There's a famous theorem by Yauch in his book on the foundations of quantum mechanics to the effect that if you introduce Galilean covariance into quantum mechanics, you can prove that the only vector potential you can introduce as Galilean covariant is electromagnetism. So somehow, Galilean covariance has an intimate connection with the existence of electromagnetic interactions in quantum mechanics, and that at first sight looked very, very odd. Isn't electromagnetism supposed to be a Lorentz covariant force? Why is it appearing in a Galilean covariant theory? And we'll take a look at that theorem and raise some doubts about it. And also, the following question. Normally, in quantum mechanics, when we introduce a symmetry that's represented by a unitary operator, so the wave function undergoes some unitary transformation associated with the symmetry, we normally assume that an operator undergoes a transformation given by u to the minus 1, where a is the operator. Now, that's true in a sense. But in what sense is it true? And I'll try to argue that that particular simple formulation of the symmetry transformation for an observable really has rather limited interest. And the transformations that we're really interested in physics are of quite a different form. And finally, I'll look at a discrete symmetry, not a continuous one, a discrete symmetry, which is the time reversal invariance of the fundamental laws of physics. And in particular, I want to do a sort of a semi-historical account of Boltzmann's H theorem, the birth of statistical mechanics, and the nature of the objections to the 1872 Boltzmann theorem, the H theorem, which was an attempt to give a mechanical underpinning to the second law of thermodynamics. And in particular, an underpinning to two principles in thermodynamics. One, the spontaneous approach of a system outside of equilibrium towards equilibrium. This has sometimes been referred to as the minus first law of thermodynamics. It's so fundamental and so implicit in everything in thermodynamics. And secondly, that systems left to themselves adiabatically enclosed and so on, the entropy of the system will either stay constant or increase. Now, Boltzmann thought in 1872 that he had given, in this particular example of a gas, using the kinetic theory of gases, he thought he had given a mechanical underpinning to this theorem, but it was clearly way too strong. The fundamental equations governing the collisions of molecules, and the collisions of this model were exactly what produced any interesting dynamics, are time reversal invariant. How can it be that you get an hour of time emerging in a theorem which starts with time reversal invariant dynamics? Where does the hour of time come in? And of course, there were a number of famous objections. There was the Loschmidt objection, then the Zermelo-Poincaré objection based on the so-called recurrence theorem. And I'll try to say something about what it was that these characters were trying to do, and in particular, what it was that Poincaré and Zermelo were trying to do in the history of the emergence of statistical mechanics, and the importance, sometimes overlooked, of Boltzmann's change of heart when he, in 1877, a few years after Loschmidt, introduced a probabilistic element, an intrinsically probabilistic element interpreting his own H theorem, and this really is the birth of statistical mechanics as we know it. This is, of course, these topics are not intended to be an exhaustive cover of anything like the importance of symmetry physics principles in physics. They really represent a collection of hobby horses. I thought I would introduce that helpful warning at this stage. Let's start with the relativity principle. And here is an excerpt from Galileo's 1632 dialogue concerning two chief world systems. And I'm going to read through it. I'm sure this is familiar to many of you, but it's a classic in the literature. Shut yourself up with some friend in the main cabin below decks on some large ship, and have with you there some flies, butterflies, and other small flying animals. Have a large bowl of water with some fish in it. Hang up a bottle that empties drop by drop into a wide vessel beneath it. With the ship standing still, observe carefully how the little animals fly with equal speeds to all sides of the cabin. The fish swim indifferently in all directions. The drops fall into the vessel beneath, and in throwing anything to your friend, you need throw it no more strongly in one direction than another, the distances being equal. Jumping with your feet together, you pass equal spaces in every direction. So in other words, what Galileo is saying is that if you perform these little experiments, you'll find that there's no privileged direction in space. The amount of effort you need to throw a body in one direction is the same as in any other direction. Animals seem to fly equally freely or with equal amounts of effort, other things being equal, in different directions in space. But I'll put aside for the moment the question of the vertical drop of the water coming out of a leaking bucket. That's something slightly different. When you observed all these things carefully, though there is no doubt that when the ship is standing still, everything must happen this way, have the ship proceed with any speed you like, so long as the motion is uniform and not fluctuating this way and that. You will discover that not the least change in all the effects named, nor could you tell from any of them whether the ship was moving or standing still. So in other words, once the ship is in motion, all of those experiments lead to exactly the same results. In other words, the ship despite its motion, despite that it picks out a privileged direction in space by its very motion, inside the cabin, all of these processes occur as if space continued to be isotropic, as if the laws of physics maintain their fundamental form, the form that they had when the ship was at rest. And of course, why is Galileo choosing a ship in this example? Because it was the means of conveyance in the early 17th century that best approximated inertial motion. Let's ask ourselves some questions about this argument. First of all, if we have drops of water falling from a leaky bucket, isn't that rather like the cannonball case when you drop a cannonball from the top of a mast on a moving ship? Isn't it the principle of inertia that tells you that the cannonball will fall to the bottom of the mast? Why do you need to appeal to the principle of relativity? So let's bracket aside the question of falling, the vertical fall of water, because that's really connected with the principle of inertia. And we shouldn't conflate the principle of inertia with the principle of relativity. They're different things. On the other hand, if we ask ourselves why it is that animals fly with seemingly equal effort in different directions, surely that has something to do with the complex forces that take place, complex dynamics when they're wings. This has nothing to do with the principle of inertia. This has something to do with forces going on present in the wings, the production of work, and so on. And this does seem to be a non-trivial claim independent of the principle of inertia. How general is it? Would Galileo, for example, apply the relativity principle to electromagnetic effects? Well, how do we know in principle that aren't electromagnetic effects occurring in the wings of animals? Nobody knew at the time. But there's no hint in Galileo, for example, that the relativity principle is limited to some group of interactions only. Sometimes we hear in physics books the relativity principle originally only applied to mechanical phenomena. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does that distinction mean between mechanical and other phenomena? In the early 19th century, this distinction didn't make any sense. It looks as if the relativity principle for Galileo is universal. It holds for all phenomena you care to mention. At least there's no hints otherwise. How close is it to the Newtonian principle of relativity? Or for that matter, the Einstein principle of relativity? Well, there's one caveat here that needs to be made, and I'm sure many of you are aware of this. For Galileo, the natural motions, for example, a ship moving uniformly on the surface of the surface of a lake, for example, the relativity principle is defined only with respect to motions that are horizontal. And by horizontal, I mean literally horizontal, that's to say hugging the surface of the Earth. Galileo was one of the last of the Aristotelians, a sense of a cosmic, a kind of a spherically symmetric cosmos. The natural motions are circular motions. And it was really Newton who first took Galileo's insight and extended it in an infinite Euclidean space to truly rectilinear motions. But other than that, that seems to be the only difference from Newton's principle in relation to Galileo's principle. Newton said the motion of bodies in a given space, that's to say bodies that are interacting either by contact forces or by actions at a distance, will be the same whether or not that given space is at rest or put into uniform motion. So I've made the point that it's distinct from the principle of inertia. It seems to be universal. It seems to hold for all interactions. How does it differ from Newtonian Einstein principles? Well, I've mentioned, because it's not really dealing with rectilinear motions, but horizontal motions. And also a point that I want should stress. Notice that in making the statement, let's put it in the following way. Suppose I have a laboratory. It's at rest with respect to an inertial frame. We perform some experiment of arbitrary nature. Whatever interactions you like to introduce in the experiment you're testing, that's fine. The claim is that if you put that laboratory now into uniform rectilinear motion with respect to the first state of rest, or perhaps state of motion, none of those phenomena that you will observe will change. Now notice, in saying that I've boosted the laboratory, I haven't specified how. And in particular, I haven't specified the coordinate transformations between the two frames in question. This is important. Galileo can state his principle without knowing anything about the Galilean coordinate transformations. Of course, in the 17th century, the Galilean coordinate transformations were taken for granted. They weren't even named. They weren't named until the early 20th century, when it was discovered they were false. But the point is that in stating this phenomenological relativity principle, you do not need to specify the nature of the boosts from a mathematical point of view. You don't have to specify the coordinate transformations. And we'll see this is very important in later on in the lecture. So it's really, it's something that's rather similar to a law of thermodynamics. It's a constraint on all the possible interactions, the form of the equation, the fundamental equations that are governing those interactions. The relativity principle is a constraint on those fundamental interactions. It's a little bit like a law of thermodynamics, a phenomenological law, which will constrain the nature of the fundamental goings-on inside some kind of heat engine. Ironically, Galileo's principle had a devastating effect on his own theory of tides. Now, why is this? You'll recall that for Galileo, if you imagine the Earth, Galileo had a very simplistic but very intuitive understanding of what motion is. Galileo thought that something either moves or it doesn't. Now, if you think of that idea with respect to empty space, it's very unclear really what that claim is. However, for Galileo, of course, being a Copernican, he believed that the Earth is in motion with respect to the Sun. In its annual orbit, there will be motion. There will be the Earth's motion around the Sun, and that will compound with motion of the rotation of the Earth. So there'll be some points on the surface of the Earth where those two motions add, and there'll be other points on the surface of the Earth where those motions subtract. They're in opposite directions, and that's the source of the tides. Very bad theory, but it's rather embarrassing because if you go back to the case of the ship, it's implicit in the ship, is it not, that this principle is independent of the seasons. That's to say, it doesn't matter whether you introduce a boost today or maybe next month or maybe in 6 months' time. In other words, no caveat is made about the fact that the relativity principle is really only defined at certain instants of time, at certain epochs. So if it's true with respect to all periods in the Earth's orbit, then there seems to be another application of the relativity principle, and that's exactly the one that rules out Galileo's theory of the tides. So let me make, first of all, the first distinction that I want to make in relation to symmetries in general, and the relativity principle in particular, is just the difference between a phenomenological symmetry, what I'll call a phenomenological symmetry, and a symmetry group principle. Now, I've just mentioned that you can specify the Galilean stroke Newtonian relativity principle without specifying the nature of the boosts, in other words, without indicating a coordinate transformation. Now, you could say this is actually the same thing about the isotropy of space. Instead of talking about a laboratory that's boosted, given a new state of inertial motion, you can simply talk about what happens when you rotate the laboratory in space. Will you get exactly the same phenomena occurring, given the same initial conditions? And again, you haven't specified exactly what you mean mathematically by a rotation. Everyone knows what it is, but you don't need to specify it. And similarly, the homogeneity of space and time for translations in space and translations in time. And again, as I said before, these are rather like the principles of thermodynamics, and that's exactly the way Einstein interpreted the relativity principle in 1905, because he was explicitly using thermodynamics as a template in introducing his theory of the electrodynamics of moving bodies. On the other hand, there are symmetry group principles. Sometimes we say, for example, what does the Einstein relativity principle mean? It means that the fundamental laws of the non-gravitational interactions, all of those interactions that are involved with matter, the cohesive nature of matter, for example, all of those interactions the fundamental equations will be covariant under, the 10-parameter inhomogeneous Lorentz or Poincaré group. So here we're specifying the coordinate transformations. Of course, you'd better also be able to find transformations on the field variables. For example, in the case of electromagnetism, it's not just the coordinates that vary, it's also the field variables, the components of the field variables, which will vary. But the fact of the matter is you can find a conjunction of field transformations and coordinate transformations that render the fundamental equations covariant. And similarly with Galilean covariance, gauge invariance, and general covariance. These are symmetries that are defined with respect explicitly with respect to certain kinds of transformations. Which are more fundamental of the two? Which are more fundamental? If you say, for example, that Einstein's principle of relativity is the Lorentz covariance of the fundamental laws of the non-gravitational interactions, then that's not the principle that he could have used in 1905, because he was trying to derive the Lorentz transformations. The whole thing would have been entirely circular. So which formulation of the principle is useful depends on the context. And I'll come back to that. The choice depends on the context, and I'll come back to that later in the talk. Of course. Very simply, I mean, take something like the second law of thermodynamics. Second law of thermodynamics says you cannot create a perpetual motion machine of a certain kind. And that perpetual motion machine is the kind that takes heat out of a reservoir and converts it entirely into work as part of its cyclic process. You just can't do that, according to the second law of thermodynamics. So that's one formulation of the second law. In other words, it's an impossibility claim that's phenomenological. Every time somebody creates some kind of heat engine, some kind of cyclic process involving the exchange of heat and work, it is impossible, according to the second law, to build such a thing in such a way that all of the heat is transformed in a given cycle into work. Now, that's a phenomenological statement. It's independent, for example, of the constitution of the working parts of the heat engine. It just says that there's something you can't do. Now, the relativity principle says, given any experiment that you perform in a laboratory, if you boost the laboratory, you will not find a change. So again, it's a kind of an impossibility claim. It's in that sense, it's rather like thermodynamics. You're not saying anything, you don't have to specify in any detail the specific dynamics of the interactions. You don't have to write down the laws of motion for them, let's say the field equations involved. You don't have to specify the coordinate transformations. You just make a claim that something's impossible. You can sort of see the analogy.
Further, today, of course, we would probably understand the relativity principle as pertaining to the state of motion, right? As Galileo's progressing and all that.
Right.
Whereas isotropy and homogeneity, they, you know, pertain specifically to the properties of space-time.
Ah, that's a very good question. Well, maybe we can come back to that a little bit later on. I'm going to claim that in the first instance, that the meaning of the isotropy of space is the claim that all the fundamental non-gravitational interactions, the theory and the equations involved in the fundamental non-gravitational interactions, do not change under a rotation, an orthogonal rotation of the coordinate system that corresponds to a rotation in space. Now, is that because space itself has a certain property? Or is it merely, in the first instance, a particular symmetry of those equations? I'm going to leave that question dangling for a moment. Maybe we can come back to it. If isotropy is a property of space, why isn't Lorentz covariance a property of space-time? And is that, anyway, the right way of thinking about it? Well, I'm glad you raised that, because I'd like to come back to that. Perhaps we can come back to the discussion. Now, the second distinction I want to make, and this has a lot to do with the nature of Noether's theorems, is first of all, let's consider continuous symmetries that depend on constant parameters. So, for example, if we're thinking of a translation in space, we're thinking of taking our laboratory and shifting it sideways in space by a fixed amount. Now, of course, that fixed amount is something that it's a vector. It's a three-vector, which we can choose to vary if we want to. But it's not something that, in a particular transformation, it doesn't vary from point to point in space and time. It's just a given constant. It's a constant parameter. These are called global symmetries, and they're the ones that are related to boosts, rotations, translations, and, for example, a global phase transformation in quantum mechanics when we multiply the wave function by a phase factor of modulus 1. And that's the subject of Noether's first theorem. But then we have local symmetries in physics, which where the transformations do depend on space and time. Think of just a typical local gauge transformation in gauge theory, say in electromagnetism. We change the four potential by adding a gradient of some scalar function of space and time. General covariance, we're introducing arbitrary coordinate transformations that may vary from point to point in space. That's what we mean by diffeomorphism. And I just wanted to mention that the minute we have a gauge structure or a structure that corresponds to a local symmetry, if we have a theory that has a local symmetry, we immediately face what appears to be a very serious problem. And that's the spectra of underdetermination. And why does that come about? And it's very simple to see. Suppose, for the sake of argument, we have a theory in which, imagine some Cauchy surface, we're specifying certain data, let's say about a collection of particles in some compact region of space, or maybe even field variables in that region of space. We solve the equations of motion, and so the system over time will evolve, and we'll have something like this. And that'll be a solution of the field equations, or let's say the equations for the motions of particles. But now we're assuming that there is a gauge symmetry, a local symmetry, associated with those equations of motion. Now, what does that mean? It means that if we take a solution, a symmetry means that if we undergo a symmetry transformation on that solution, we can generate a new solution. So a symmetry is a way of taking one solution and generating a new one. But now, imagine if we have a symmetry that depends on space and time, so it's a local symmetry. We can ensure that that transformation is the identity in an interval in the neighborhood of our original Cauchy data. So in other words, the transformation doesn't change the data at this particular given time. It only kicks in, as it were, later, because it depends on time. So in other words, we can generate a new solution that now looks like this. Well, we've got a system of partial differential equations that are underdetermined. This is not the same thing as something stochastic happening. It just means that if the world is deterministic, it just means our partial differential equations don't have the correct mathematical property of generating unique solutions. And now what? Now, of course, this is exactly what happens in general relativity. And this is what led Einstein to losing 2 years in the development of general relativity, because he realized he wanted, on all kinds of intuitive grounds, to have general covariance for his field equations. And he realized that general covariance gives rise to underdetermination for exactly this reason. This is sometimes referred to as the hole argument. He himself referred to it as the hole argument, where instead of having a situation like this, you consider a region of space-time where there's a patch. And you can introduce a diffeomorphism, which is the identity on that patch and different everywhere else. Or the contrary. And you can see that you're going to get underdetermination in predicting what's going on inside that patch, given information outside it. Of course, how did Einstein get out of this conundrum? By realizing that if you think hard about what you mean by actually doing experiments, and you're thinking operationally, what is it you're doing in general relativity? Well, for example, suppose you've got particles that are freely falling. You're looking to see, for example, or they're moving, their relative motions are such that there may be collisions of particles. Now, those collisions are diffeomorphically invariant. They're gauge invariant. Whether two particles collide is just it's a fact that doesn't depend on the choice of coordinate system or anything else. So he referred to point coincidence argument. What he ended up concluding was, actually, it's OK in this case, because all the observables are diffeomorphically invariant. They're gauge independent. So actually, these two descriptions that arise by by taking one solution and generating a new solution by way of this local symmetry really correspond to one and the same thing physically. So actually, when we're in general relativity, we should never talk about the G mean U field. We should always talk about the G mean U field up to a diffeomorphism. So it's really an equivalence class of G mean U's. We should always think of that in general relativity. Now, of course, exactly the same thing happens in electromagnetism. So if we write down Maxwell's equations in terms of the four potential, we can always introduce, as I mentioned before, a transformation on the four potential, which is equal to the gradient of some scalar field phi, where this will depend on space and time. This will be this field will depend on space and time. Now, why doesn't that likewise give rise to a problem of underdetermination? We can generate a solution of A mu, and we can generate another solution which agree on a certain area, a certain kind of Cauchy surface. Well, it turns out that when we look at the observables in classical electrodynamics, and in general the case with gauge theories, they're independent of the choice of the gauge. In other words, for example, the Lorentz force law, the law that tells you how a charged particle will accelerate in the field, isn't gauge independent. Here, I'd like to just raise a question. This is how we get around the problem of underdetermination in gauge theories, generally. We could always say, given a theory that has a local symmetry, we could always say, well, we're just going to impose by fiat that the observables are gauge independent. But shouldn't the theory be telling us what the observables are in the first place? That's to say, if it's the case that our understanding of what the observables are should be given by the nature of the theory, and not necessarily just by looking at its symmetry principles, why is nature so kind as to always make it such that when we do have a gauge theory, it turns out that the observables are gauge invariant? Perhaps if anybody has a position on that question, I'd like to hear it. It puzzles me. Anyway, the local symmetries are the subject of Noether's second theorem, and we'll come back to that later. Now, just a word about the observability of the phenomenological principles. Let's just go back to Galileo. What makes the relativity principle, what gives it its bite? What makes it empirical? In other words, how do I know whether the ship is moving or not? If I introduce a boost on the ship, how can I determine that actually anything has happened at all? Why isn't it a little bit like a gauge transformation? Why isn't the Galilean boost rather like a gauge transformation in the sense that I can't tell before or after whether anything has happened? Well, of course, the reason is because we're looking at a subsystem of the universe when we define these phenomenological principles. We're not looking at the universe as a whole. Galileo's ship is relatively isolated. The cabin of the ship is relatively isolated from the rest of the universe. But we external observers, not somebody inside the cabin, but externally, we can see that the ship has been put into motion with respect to the shore. That's to say, a phenomenological principle, symmetry principle, always has empirical bite, because there's been an act of transformation of one relatively isolated subsystem of the universe with respect to the rest of the universe. There's been some kind of change in its configuration with respect to the rest of the universe. These phenomenological principles are not defined at a cosmological level. That's the first point. Then there's a distinction in the mathematics. Well, when we describe, for example, a Galilean transformation, we can interpret that one of two ways. Or, for example, when we rotate a system using an orthogonal transformation between Cartesian coordinates, just a rotation in three-dimensional space, we can interpret that mathematical transformation one of two ways. We can say, well, the system is the way it was before. We've done nothing active on the system, in particular its configuration with the rest of the universe. But we've just introduced coordinates, which are abstract devices, and we've rotated the coordinates. And that's a passive transformation. On the other hand, that very same mathematical transformation could represent the actual active transformation of the body with respect to the rest of the universe. There seems to be, I mean, there is in general, for global symmetries, a dual interpretation of the symmetry transformation. And this is well known. Is there a similar dual interpretation of the local symmetries? And apparently not. You cannot take, for example, a diffeomorphism in general relativity and say, well, this is an active or this is a passive transformation. The distinction doesn't make any sense. Now, what about gauge? What about gauge? Well, there is a very interesting paper by Etuft, of course, who's one of the great figures in gauge theory in the Standard Model in 1980 in Scientific American, where Etuft says the following. Suppose that we have a two-slit experiment involving, say, electrons. So this is the famous arrangement you see so often in discussions of the foundations of quantum mechanics. You have a source of electrons. They come out one by one, very low intensity beam of electrons. They go through a pair of slits. And individually, they create, well, of course, they're captured individually on the screen. But if you build up a statistical ensemble of these things, one after the other, you end up with these characteristic interference patterns. Now, suppose for the sake of argument, just beside one of these slits, we introduce a phase shifter. Let's not worry how you do this in practice. But it'll be some device that doesn't absorb the electron. It simply slows it down for some period of time. It's like introducing a refractive index that slows this part of the wave function down in relation to that one for some fixed period of time. Another way of putting this is that it introduces a relative phase factor between the two components of the wave function, the components associated with passing through that slit and through that slit. Now, imagine also that the two parts of the wave function are non-overlapping, which is what you'd pretty much expect when they're just emerging from the two slits. Is that a gauge transformation? You see, you're going from psi equals, well, let's just, for the sake of simplicity, assume that there's some kind of symmetry in the system, so I'll have a normalization factor of root 2. So if that's slit 1 and that's slit 2, Is that a gauge transformation? Is that a local gauge transformation? Etuft says it is, because it's spatiotemporally dependent. It's only valid for, it doesn't matter whether you put it here or here, but let's imagine that you've got your phase shifter here. It's only affecting that spatial region of the wave function and not that spatial region. Therefore, it's spatiotemporal dependent. Therefore, that's a local gauge transformation. But notice that if you do that, and this is absolutely something that's done all the time in laboratories throughout the world, and if not with electrons, and certainly with neutron interferometers, you're going to get a shift of the interference pattern. The first thing that will happen is that you'll get a shift of the interference pattern. Etuft says, this tells you that the Schrodinger equation is not symmetric under local gauge transformations. Now, there's a sense in which that's true, but there's also a sense in which it's false. So the question is, and then Etuft says, well, of course, we can get around this by then introducing an electromagnetic field. And in particular, he refers to the Harno-Bohm effect, where if you introduce the appropriate magnetic field, you can undo the effect of the phase shifter, and you get back to your original interference pattern. Now, is that a good argument? Is a phase shifter in one of the beams of an interferometer a local gauge transformation? And are we showing, because we get a shift in the interference pattern, that quantum mechanics is not locally gauge invariant? Well, this is surprisingly subtle, this question. And I'll mention that there is a counterpoint of view. Catherine Brading and I published a paper a few years ago where we claimed that this was not a local gauge transformation. It certainly looks like it at first sight, but it's not strictly a local gauge transformation. A local gauge transformation is like a diffeomorphism in general relativity, it just does not have an active interpretation. So I would argue myself that gauge, local gauge transformations are just like diffeomorphisms in general relativity. They don't have, the distinction between active and passive doesn't really mean anything. But this is controversial. Well, in the last part of the talk, I'm going to say something about the uses of the relativity principle. This is really, when Einstein's 1905 paper really put symmetry principles on a pedestal in physics. I think it really was a turning point in the history of physics by using symmetry principles as postulates, by imposing them on theories rather than seeing them emerge. And this had, of course, an enormous impact, for example, on the development of the Standard Model. So I think it's interesting for us to look at the uses of the relativity principle, but I'll start with Albert Einstein. Incidentally, what I had in mind for these lectures was to stop for a break at roughly midday, just for five or 10 minutes, then coming back, making a few more remarks to finish the lecture, and then opening it to discussion. Is that reasonable? Well, in that case, let me just then go through Albert Einstein's argument of 1705. Before I do that, I just should mention, by the way, let's just a quick word about coordinate transformations in physics. Suppose, counterfactually, you had learned general relativity before you learned special relativity. Now, in general relativity, one of the slogans is that coordinates are just labeling devices. And this is one of the motivations for general covariance. It should be the case that any theory of physics should be able to be described in generally covariant form, or you might call that coordinate general form. After all, aren't coordinates just labels? So if you introduce a coordinate transformation, you're merely introducing a redescription of the system. There's no active interpretation. But then how come coordinate transformations between inertial frames contain physics? How does that come about? Strangely, this issue, I don't think has ever really been satisfactorily discussed in the literature. I may be wrong about this. If somebody can tell me a good discussion of this. Now, recently, Hans Westman and Sebastianus Sonnigo have published a very interesting paper on this issue. And it may well be the last word. I'm not entirely sure. But I think the paper itself is extremely well motivated. Now, Bianca, if I'm overlooking something, and maybe if I'm overlooking something that you've done, please tell me. But I think this is really an important issue. How is it that by thinking of theories like special relativity as a limiting case, the appropriate limiting case of general relativity, how is it that we understand the coordinate transformations between inertial frames as having physics, containing physics? Well, what we normally understand is that, for example, for two coordinate systems in the standard configuration, where the relative motion is along the x prime axis, we can see a longitudinal space deformation or length change factor emerging. We see that in the case of the transverse. There's a possibility of a transverse change in the shape of a rigid body. And in the case of a time transformation, we're assuming, of course, that these transformations are linear. And that's very natural in the case of coordinate transformations in inertial frames. We introduce an alpha term here, which represents the coefficient of the relativity of simultaneity, and a dilation factor that represents the ratio of proper time of a single clock between two events on its world line to the coordinate time read off by two distant synchronized clocks at rest. And these are completely general. And of course, the Galilean transformations are simply one case where alpha is equal to zero, there's no relativity of simultaneity, and all these other terms are equal to one. But we've already assumed that there's physics in these transformations, and how do we do that? Well, amongst other things, we have to make two assumptions. We have to assume the universality of the behavior of rods and clocks. The length change factors for rods and the time dilation factor for clocks do not depend on the constitution of these objects, nor in the means by which the rods and the clocks were boosted. So when you put the rods and clocks into motion, you let them settle down again, and whatever happens to them, whether they're contracted or dilated or expanded or whatever as a result of their motion, will be independent of their constitution. And herein lies really the miracle of kinematics. Why does this universality hold? Why should a steel body contract or expand in motion in the same way that a wooden one does? Why should a clock that's made out of, for example, somehow you can use the strong force to build a clock, why should its periodicity coincide, and its dilation in particular, why should that coincide with a clock that's built out of electromagnetic forces? Well, then there's a stipulation that you have to make. This is not so much a question of the world, but a question of how we define our coordinates. Any object that can act as a rigid ruler in the frame S when it's at rest, the unprimed frame, when stationary relative to that frame, retains that role in its new rest frame S prime when boosted. So for example, if this is a ruler at rest with respect to the unprimed frame, if it's put into a uniform motion, that ruler, and allowed to settle down after that boosting process, so its internal constitution comes back to equilibrium, then we're going to assume that it's also a ruler in its new rest frame. And of course, this was implicit in 1905 for Einstein, but he makes it absolutely explicit in a paper in 1910. If you don't have these assumptions, and you don't assume that, for example, rigid rulers are measuring coordinate spatial displacements in your coordinate system, and clocks are measuring temporal displacements, then none of this makes any sense. Now, the question is, did anyone prior to Einstein fully understand this? Certainly not amongst the ether theorists, including Poincaré, who was the first to specify the Lorentz transformations and even give the correct velocity transformations associated with them. How is the universality justified? Well, we're just going to have to take that on board at the moment. How do you justify the fact that all of these bodies act miraculously in this universal way? But arguably, there was one person prior to Einstein who understood this, and this was the relatively little-known Albert Einstein. The coincidences with Einstein are remarkable. Albert Einstein was also born in what was then what we now call Germany, and he was working in Switzerland at a novelty in the Swiss economy. That's to say, there was sort of a precursor to a patent office in Bern, of all places. And Einstein had been reading Newton's Principia, and Newton in the Principia has a proof of the relativity principle. It's corollary 5 of his laws of motion. Now, the problem with Newton's derivation of the relativity principle is that it contains a non sequitur. Now, what Newton had to assume, over and above his second law of motion, was that all of the forces and the masses associated with Newtonian particles, when you boost them, that's to say you introduce a new state of uniform motion, rectilinear motion, that those forces and masses are invariant. That does not follow from his laws of physics, his three laws. So Einstein said, well, let's assume the relativity principle. Now, let's not try to prove it. Actually, Newton himself had put the relativity principle as a postulate in his pre-Principia writings. It only becomes a theorem in the Principia. So Einstein thought, let's put the relativity principle as a postulate, let's elevate it to a postulate, and let's assume Newton's second law, F is equal to ma. And let's assume that the velocity independence of masses of forces in exactly the way that Newton did in his derivation of the relativity principle. Now, why is that plausible? Well, just think, for example, of the gravitational force. Do the masses involved in m1, m2 of d squared, do they depend on the relative state of motion, on the state of motion, for example, of the gravitating bodies with respect to absolute space? They do not. It's implicit in the theory of gravity that the gravitational charges, the gravitational masses, don't change depending on the state of motion of the body with respect to absolute space. So it's natural to to extrapolate this idea to arbitrary forces. Now, if you do that, you can easily see that if you write down F is equal to MA or MX double dot in the unprime frame, you can easily see that equation is going to be covariant. Not only covariant, invariant. It'll turn out, because the M is invariant and because the F is invariant, X double dot prime is going to be equal to X double dot. In other words, accelerations will be invariant. Now, that's a very strong constraint in the coordinate transformations. And in particular, they imply that the dilation factor is equal to the square root of the longitudinal length change factor. And secondly, that there's no relativity of simultaneity. Now, by the way, I'm being a little bit dodgy here, because I haven't said how Einstein synchronizes clocks when he defines his coordinate systems. But I'll come back to that if anyone's interested. But at any rate, some kind of synchrony convention has been implicitly introduced. Otherwise, you can't even set up your coordinate systems to start with. And it turns out that because of these constraints, there's no relativity of simultaneity. Now, you're not there yet. You need something more. Einstein assumed reciprocity. Now, what does that mean? We have two frames, S and S prime. S prime with respect to S has a speed v in the positive x prime axis, in that sense. What is the speed of S relative to S prime? Well, let's assume it's minus v. Now, this is not a convention. Once you've specified how you synchronize your clocks in both frames, it's an empirical question. By the way, it's easy to invent kinematics that violate this convention. I'm not saying they're necessarily plausible, but they're certainly well-defined. They're self-consistent. So Einstein assumed reciprocity, and he also assumed spatial isotropy. I'm not going to go through the details, but the result is the Galilean transformations. So Einstein anticipated Einstein's calculation, or let's say his approach to the Lorentz transformations by exactly 200 years, showing that the Galilean transformations can also be considered a consequence of an argument that involves a fundamental symmetry principle or a pair of symmetry principles at its heart. And what are the symmetry principles? The relativity principle and spatial isotropy. So the Galilean transformations are now a theorem rather than just an assumption. And As a health warning, I think you should read this quote from Albert Einstein. Let's have a break. Should we say 10 minutes? Would that be reasonable? 10 past 12, we'll come back.